My name's Paul Bestall. This is Mysteries and Monsters on the Paranormal UK Radio Network. Welcome to Mysteries and Monsters. This week, we welcome legendary paranormal investigator, author, and podcast host, Lon Strickler, to the show. Lon's website, Phantoms and Monsters, was one of the first paranormal websites I ever stumbled across back in 2005, and Lon has continued to be a continued presence in the world of paranormal and mysterious phenomena. We discuss his paranormal experiences, his website, Phantoms and Monsters, the resurgence in the Lake Michigan Mothman sightings, ufology, and one of the most unusual UFO abduction cases in the modern era, that of David Eckhart. I trust you'll enjoy our conversation. So, before we get there, once again, thanks to you, the listeners, for your lovely emails and reviews this week. It really makes our day to hear from you, so please drop us a line with any comments, guest selections, or if you'd like to appear on the show. Just drop us a line to mysteriesandmonsters@gmail.com. Don't forget, you can find us on Facebook under Mysteries and Monsters. We're on Twitter and Instagram as Mysteries Monsters. And you can also subscribe to our YouTube channel, which essentially we're going to have to sort out. Podbean have stopped uploading podcasts to YouTube, which essentially means we're probably going to have to move to somebody else. So as soon as I know more, I'll let you all know. So thank you for your patience. Anyway, enough of me waffling. Let's join Lon Strickler. My guest today is author and investigator, Lon Strickler. Lon has been writing about unexplained phenomena for years and has appeared on countless TV shows and podcasts, as well as being the host of the marvellous Arcane Radio. Lon, we are delighted to welcome you to Mysteries and Monsters. How are we?
Thanks for having me. I'm doing fine.
Oh, absolute pleasure. Lon, you're probably, with the greatest respect, probably one of the most prolific and long-term paranormal investigators that I think most people are aware of. Were you one of this generation where you were kind of intrigued by things you saw in the 70s that kind of opened your mind to the world of paranormal, Lon? Or was it personal experience that kind of dragged you into this weird and wonderful subject?
Oh, it was personal. I was born and raised near the Gettysburg Battlefield in South Central Pennsylvania, which is where I do reside again. I lived down in Maryland near Baltimore for about 40 years, and I moved back up here. But I used to spend a lot of time on the battlefield as a kid, and I used to ride my bike out to the battlefield, which was about 10, 11 miles from my home, and I used to spend afternoons there, especially in the summer. So I think I was around 8 years old or so, and I was out there in an area called the Death Valley, which was well, there was a lot of activity during the second day of the battle, which was between Little Round Top, Devil's Den, the wheat field, in that area. And all of a sudden, I just started experiencing all kinds of phenomena. I was hearing gunfire, smelling gunpowder, seeing apparitions, screaming, the whole nine yards. It all just suddenly occurred. And, you know, I had known previous to that I was intuitive, but, you know, being a kid, you're 8 years old, you don't know what's going on. And quite frankly, it's not like I was growing up in a haunted house or that is, I was experiencing all kinds of things when I was, you know, a child. But that did happen, and that made me more aware of what I was capable of, and that was being able to sense spirit energy, which is what, you know, kind of led me into the paranormal. So when beyond that, and back in the, and this was the early 70s, mid-70s, I, you know, that wasn't a big thing back then. Of course, you know, paranormal investigation, very few people even did that, let alone talking about it when people think you're crazy. So, you know, a few of my friends knew that I was interested in it, and they knew I had some abilities. And I was just like word of mouth, I'd investigate a house or a business or a location and just give my assessment of what was going on. And, you know, that's how it started.
Yeah, so, it's always quite interesting when people feel that they have that kind of connection and can sense things, Lon. And I think for a lot of people, they try to dismiss it or put it to one side. But you certainly seem to have just embraced it and run with it, really. And it's probably responsible for getting you in the position you are these days.
Yeah, that may be true. I mean, it was just like, I can't really say it was a hobby, but it was, you know, it was just something where I was aware of it. And then I would occasionally use it if I got into a specific location where I was sensing things. And, you know, what I did up until 1981, 82 was just, you know, hauntings and such. But I had a Bigfoot encounter in 1981, and that kind of put me on the other road. I mean, that just kind of opened everything up for me as far as cryptids go. I knew about Bigfoot, but I wasn't, you know, I wasn't really into the cryptids and such. But when that occurred, I went in it wholeheartedly, and that's, you know, that's how things progressed. And over the years, I've been collecting incidents, reports, and such, until I started the blog in 2005.
Yeah, which is obviously where Phantoms and Monsters was born,
right?
And took you on. I mean, is it, as I've spoken to several people that have gone into this investigation and utilized their abilities or how they feel. They can sense things, Lon. Was it the kind of thing that you'd kind of built up a reputation locally where people would come to you, or were you kind of on the hunt for interesting stories and that's where it sort of developed from?
Yeah, it was mostly me going to locations and looking out, you know, for myself. If I would be, let's say I would be at a location somewhere looking, and somebody would come up and we just get the conversation and they'd tell me about something, then I may go look into it for them. I mean, it, you know, it was few and far between at that time, but, you know, that was about the extent of it early until I had the encounter. Then, you know, things just took off.
Well, yeah, I think that it's quite interesting because I've spoken to several people who, especially when it comes to cryptids, they usually have quite an ambivalent opinion about it, that, you know, maybe they're not particularly interested in cryptids and cryptozoology until something peculiar happens to them. Then, and it just basically completely changes their mindset overnight. And clearly that seems to have been the situation for yourself, Lon.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that just changed everything. And, you know, at the time it was just mostly Bigfoot and, you know, Sasquatch, hairy hominids, and whatever. But, you know, I live in a part of the country where we have a lot of phenomena. And, I mean, there's a vast amount of phenomena that occurs in this part of the United States. And, you know, as things progressed, I started investigating much, much more. And, you know, I had always been interested in the winged humanoid phenomena. And, especially after 1988, when I had an encounter with two other people of a winged being, and you know, it just kind of spread from there. And you know, I had done a lot of traveling. I had stopped places and talk to people. And you know, back then it wasn't a matter of just, it was just a matter of just writing things down and keeping notes. So, yeah, as time progressed, it got to the point where somebody had actually told me that, you know, you ought to write a blog or you ought to put stuff down in writing. And I never did any writing at all. And, you know, that's where it started at.
Yeah, I mean, it is, as we touch on there, the winged humanoids and strange things. Obviously, recently I had the pleasure of speaking to someone you know particularly well, and you're obviously mentioned in the book, Tobias Weiland.
Right.
In regards to this kind of resurgence over, that's originally started in the Chicago area with what people were responding to and reporting as weird flying phenomenon. And it's, when I was speaking to Tobias, it was very interesting to look at, he basically, this seemed to have been going on for quite a long time, but it was only sort of the recent situation, Lon, that had basically brought a lot more people coming out of the woodwork to say, oh yeah, well, I saw something 10 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, there were three encounters in Chicago in 2011. Hmm. And they were all three reported to on the MUFON CMS database. And, you know, there was a bit of a stir back then about it. But, you know, there were no real tangible reports between 2011 and 2017 when there were more reports that started coming in. Hmm. And, you know, I was told about some of the reports, the earlier reports in 2017 that were coming in. And I got quite interested in it because it just kept building. Hmm. And it kept progressing. And it got to the point where I started soliciting reports throughout the Chicagoland area. Hmm. And I had a gentleman who I worked with, Manuel Navaret, with UFO Clearinghouse. And he and I had been receiving reports. Then Tobias, I got in contact with Tobias since he lived nearby. Hmm. And then he got interested, and then, you know, he started working along with me on the on this phenomena. So we had a team built up by that time. We had several other people. Vance Nesbitt, Rosemary Ellen Guiler was involved with us. A few other people, and it just progressed from there. And the sightings themselves were, you know, they were unbelievable sightings. I mean, but the witnesses were very, very credible. And the fact that they didn't embellish on their sightings and what they had originally described and such just made it all that much better.
Mm. I think what's always I've found incredibly intriguing about that, this current situation, because it's still going on now, is the fact that it's, for all the weird phenomenon that we're aware of out there, Lon, this seems to be one of the few examples of something happening in an urban setting, which I think stands it apart from quite a lot of other aspects of the weird.
Yeah, I mean, you don't really hear of any widespread phenomena occurring in an urban area. And in fact, I believe this is the only group of incidents like this to have ever occurred. Now, of course, we had the Mothman of Point Pleasant sightings back in 66 and 67, which were probably around 30 documented cases. Of course, there may have been others seen, but there was a lot of other phenomena going on at the time. Then, of course, it accumulated to the point where the Silver Bridge collapsed. And many of the residents and those following kind of blamed that as a harbinger to the Mothman, where then 46 people had died on the bridge. Mm-hmm. And of course, that being a small town, you know, when you have a large tragedy like that, people tend to find an excuse as to why it happened. So, of course, you know, you had the local boogeyman going on with the Mothman, and then people just went ahead and decided, well, that was the reason why the book collapsed. But quite frankly, I don't really buy into the harbinger port and the doom theory. There have been some examples over the years. But, you know, what's been going on in Chicago, I really don't believe there's any ties to any type of disaster, but there were a lot of people that really did believe that was going to happen. And in fact, that 2017, when we were taking the majority of the reports, I had people calling me 24/7, just residents of the city who were scared to death that something was going to happen.
Yeah, well, I think that's the thing, because, like you say, the reputation of it becoming a harbinger as something that's obviously built and built over the last 20 years. I think maybe it's because of the way the Mothman is portrayed in the film, the Richard Gere film that came out at the beginning of the century. But I think, I mean, Keel, when he was obviously, knee deep in all that strangeness going on in Point Pleasant, because, like I said, the Mothman is just a small aspect of all that lawn. It was remarkable, like you say, and I think that some people automatically just put faith in the fact that this creature, whatever it was bad news. Whether or not there was any real sort of supporting evidence, they were convinced that it had nothing good to bring.
Well, the I have looked into this phenomenon at Point Pleasant for a long time now, and I have been there several times. I've done some investigations, and after a while, I came to the conclusion that I thought that the Mothman was actually a flesh and blood being, but it may most likely came through a portal or some type of other reality. I think it was a summoned being, to be honest with you. Because the area around the well, that whole area was said to have been cursed to some degree, though it had been an area of habitation by the indigenous Shawnee and other earlier tribes, and there's been a lot of warring and activity there over the years, and I think that there is a prevalent spirit or strong energy that pervades around the area. And I think this Mothman entity was summoned by this spirit as a guardian or a sentry. And for whatever reason, that's something we really can't pinpoint. But the fact that when these sightings did occur in Point Pleasant, and particularly around the West Virginia Ordnance Works, the Mothman beings was somewhat aggressive, and it was chasing people and scaring them, and so it was somewhat an aggressive being. Now, the fact that when the bridge collapsed and it was thought to have been a harbinger, well, like you said, John Keel had been in looking into the phenomena, but there was a lot of other stuff going on at the time. There were a lot of UFO sightings, a lot of paranormal sightings, and later the Men in Black phenomena occurred. So, I think John Keel kind of went along with the flow and kind of connected it all together for the most part. But, I'm not sure that this is really what happened, and it's something that we still look into. I'm still very much interested in gathering evidence about the occurrences, and in fact, over the years, I have received reports of a very similar type winged beings in and around Point Pleasant, in up and down the Ohio River Valley.
Yeah, I mean it's, and I think it's one of those mystery cases, Lon, that's, here we are, 53 years later, and people are still hungry for it. I mean, obviously, most notably recently, we've had the Small Town Monsters films, in regards to the Mothman, and they've got the final part of their trilogy coming out this year, The Mothman Legacy. So, it's one of those cases that I think has just continued to grow, and like you say, I think, on face value, people, if they don't know much about the case or Keel's work, they tend to just focus on the Mothman. But as you say, it was a whole range of phenomenon that just it's and it was just over such a what, 14 months, I think, 13 months that it occurred. So it was a very specific window of time, like you say, that created such a strange scenario across a variety of things.
Well, the connection between the current sightings of these winged humanoids, I really don't believe that there is much comparison to what happened in Point Pleasant, other than this thing had some of them had red eyes, but the wing structure for the most part was much different. The way it acted was somewhat different. It wasn't aggressive. So there were major differences. The fact that the moniker of Mothman was pinned on this being in Chicago was mostly done by the press. And I kind of went with it for the most part. I was calling it the Phantom first, the Chicago Phantom. And I still call it that occasionally, but when you see Chicago Mothman, people then know what you're talking about. So, but it didn't look much like what people saw in Point Pleasant. But the fact that it is a winged humanoid-like being, it's very unusual. I mean, the fact people have seen winged beings for centuries, quite frankly, and I've investigated winged humanoids all over the country, even into Canada, for many years now. So, this isn't something that's kind of centered in just one or two locations. This phenomena does happen, and occasionally it does happen in groups.
Yeah, I mean it is, I mean obviously it's the most well-known one, but like you say, there does seem to have been sporadic reports, as you refer to, that go back quite a long time from all over the north of America, and it seems to have been it's one of those phenomena, I think, that perhaps a lot of people don't really look into that much. I mean, obviously, right now it's clearly something that's gained a lot of attention, but it's part of that Fortean phenomena, like you say, that just seems to defy explanation in regards to what these people claim to see.
Yeah, it's an interesting phenomena. It's very it's enigma basically, because we just don't know why it's there, why it's appearing. These sightings are very fleeting sightings. Many of them are at night. They're so quick that some people seem to be in shock when they see it, and not really thinking about grabbing their phone and taking a photograph of it. But many times it does, it's only seen for a matter of seconds. So, I get people ask me all the time, well, why don't you get a photograph? This and that. Well, that just isn't in the cards. I mean, it just seems to people have this shock factor when they have an encounter and they're not even thinking about taking a photograph.
Yeah. Well, I think anything like that essentially rocks your idea of how the world works, Lon,
Oh, yeah.
is enough to just basically knock you for six. You don't know how to react because you are seeing something that, to all normal explanations, it defies and flies in the face of everything that anybody would probably know at that point. So regardless, it would just stun you, I suppose.
Yeah, it does, and that's with any phenomenon, particularly anything cryptid. You don't expect to see it; it happens, and you're just floored. And basically, a couple minutes later, you think, I should have took a photograph of this thing, but
Yeah, well,
that's the way it happens.
absolutely. I think it's one of those. Yeah, everybody, it's easy to say, oh, well, I wish I'd done this. But I think, like you say, you just don't know how you're going to react both emotionally and sensibly to seeing something so peculiar.
Absolutely.
So, do you think this is something that is unique to this particular area, this consistent amount of sighting? Because it does seem to be developing as we speak, really, because it seems that now more and more people are becoming comfortable with coming forwards to it. And I think, as with any phenomenon, once one story gets out the bottle, it tends to kind of make people relax, Lon. Have you found that in regards to the people coming forward to yourself?
That may be. I don't know. That's hard to really answer. I guess it depends who sees it. Mm. And, you know, I'm quite sure there are a lot of people that have seen this thing that just haven't reported it. Mm. But, you know, a lot of times when you have a witness, first thing they do is start Googling, and they're lucky enough to find you, and then they make you part of what they saw. But a lot of times it's hard to go much further with them. And we have been fairly lucky to be able to get on site with some of these people. I'm pretty sure we have talked to at least 98% of the witnesses, and we're up to almost 100 witnesses now. Mm. So, but you know, there are subtle changes. It's just not happening in Chicago. Mm. I've been taking reports at this time, a 250-mile radius of Chicago. Mm. And, but the fact that it's being seen within that radius is also remarkable, because we haven't been receiving any of the reports to this degree before that. So, of course, you know, the area around Chicago, in northern Illinois, Indiana, and southern Wisconsin has always been well known for strange phenomena, in particular winged phenomena, because there have been all kinds of strange reports over the years. Thunderbird sightings, pterosaur-like sightings, other winged phenomena. It's, the indigenous, the Indians who lived there used to talk about these beings. You know, when Seth Breedlove made his movie about the Illinois winged beings, and of course he included the Mothman in Chicago. He very well described how, you know, how a lot of this lore is well known within, you know, within the indigenous. So it's interesting, but like I said, it's not the only place where this occurs.
So is there any other particular area of the states where this seems to be that can perhaps rival the Chicagoland area in regards to these reports, Lon? Is it seems to just occur in specific little places, just, you know, flying through or of that regard?
Well, here in Pennsylvania, in south central Pennsylvania, and there have been some areas in western Pennsylvania, there have been sightings of winged beings. The area where I live at, which is south central Pennsylvania, people have reported various winged phenomena to me. And this is the area where I had my encounter as well. So I believe at this point now, I've received 11 to 12 sightings over the years in just this part of the country or part of the state. I had, during the time that this was going on in Chicago in 2017, also had 3 sightings in Pasco County, Florida. Mm-hmm. Very similar being the red eyes, the whole 9 yards, very bat-like wings, just like what people were seeing in Chicago. And we had various sightings in other places, in particular Texas and in southern Ontario. Mm-hmm. So, and as well, we had a couple in Ohio. So, yeah, I mean, these aren't the only places, but, you know, like I said, it was more prevalent in the upper Midwest.
Yeah. And I think it's clearly one of those, you know, when I had the pleasure of speaking with Linda Godfrey, she was very surprised, obviously, because Linda is uniquely attached to Dogman more than anyone, I think, Lon. So it's very interesting where this, because this is a very strange and quite specific phenomenon that seems to have really developed more so the same as the Dogman. These are kind of things that have really come into their own as kind of standalone Fortean situations, where unless you know, like you say, in regards to the indigenous legends and things, you would probably assume that these were just brand new things that people were seeing. But there clearly is a historical precedent for such things?
Well, the legends about the upright canines and the and some of these winged beings, they are described by the indigenous as being a spirit based type of entity, as opposed to flesh and blood. But quite frankly, I'm pretty sure that most are actual corporeal or flesh and blood. You know, Linda has been investigating the Bray Road, Beast of Bray Road, and other upright canines in southern Wisconsin for years. Well, we've been getting sightings of these winged beings in particularly Packard, these same areas. So it is an area where a lot of different phenomena occurs. It's a hot spot, basically, you know, just like we have here as well in Pennsylvania. We've been having these upright canine sightings here in central Pennsylvania, I guess more so since 2014. We've recorded about 26 encounters. But, you know, traditionally, historically, there have been sightings of these werewolf or upright canine beings as well. So, you know, what they are, you know, we really don't know. Are they supernatural or are they flesh and blood? You know, there's different camps. Some people believe, just like with Bigfoot, it's flesh and blood. But I particularly believe that most cryptids in general are supernatural or able to either cloak or move between worlds.
Yeah, I think that it's one of those things as well that obviously as we learn more in regards to the possibility of additional dimensions, and as you referred to a couple of times there, Lon, in regards to portals, there seems to be a real kind of growth in that kind of theory. Primarily, I think, because some of these weird creatures that are spotted all over the world just defy explanation.
Sure.
And we don't have, you know, with the greatest of respect, upright canines are nothing we've come across in the fossil record, regardless, whereas, you know, people will always point to Gigantopithecus in regards to a potential sort of ancestor in regards to Bigfoot. So it's intriguing because for some of these creatures, it's almost as if they are otherworldly and we are somehow looking into where they exist in whatever term you want to put around them.
Yeah, there's no relic record or any type of fossil record of anything like this. And, you know, of course, since we haven't found a Bigfoot body or an upright canine body or, you know, other evidence, physical evidence, you know, you got to start thinking a little bit outside the box when it starts to comes to an explanation. You know, there are there had been Bigfoot traditionalists that are starting to become more open-minded about the phenomena as well. And, you know, the fact that quantum computing is starting to become more of reality, and in fact, I believe it's going to become more mainstream as time goes on, where people are going to be having access to this, to the technology, we may start coming up with some answers of what's really going on.
Absolutely. I think anything like that can only benefit us on a variety of things. And I think it's interesting for me that certain phenomena now seem to be being looked at on a more scientific level, Lon, because I think, like you say, people are having to open their minds up because there is a distinct lack of actual physical evidence for certain things that kind of just makes people think, well, it can't possibly exist. But clearly people are seeing things and they're seeing something that defies explanation.
Yeah, I believe that as time goes on, science and the supernatural are going to start becoming more intertwined. And I think when that does happen, we'll start getting more answers.
I think there's, as I mentioned before we started chatting, there is one case that I've always found incredibly strange
primarily because a lot of people have tried to disprove this gentleman and come up short. And that's David Eckhart, who I believe, I'm not sure if he still does, but he did live in Pensacola in Florida, I believe.
Yeah, he lives in the area. He still does. Yeah.
I mean, that whole situation is extremely peculiar because David is exactly the type of person you would not expect to find himself in the middle of this. And I find it odd that more people don't speak about David's case because I just find it incredible.
Yeah, I was lucky to find David. What happened was in 2010, I saw the video, the original video that he had produced of the two frames that he had put in a loop that showed some type of small humanoid being standing in the doorway of his bathroom, which, you know, in his bedroom. And I became intrigued. I didn't, you know, of course, I didn't know what it was. And so I was able to get a hold of him. Now, this had actually occurred 4 to 5 years before I even contacted David. He had been trying for many years to get MUFON to get involved with his case. And they just didn't give it any credence, which is kind of their MO anyway, because when it comes to entities, they are very rarely wanting to get involved with the investigation. And that still happens to this day. But anyway, that's another story. But they, you know, I got a hold of David and we got to talking, and, you know, I was talking to David literally 3 to 4 hours a day. And, you know, I didn't really start believing David until about 6 months into our conversations. Seriously, you know, I thought he may have been having more of a paranormal haunting or such as opposed to something to do with alien beings. Yeah. Until I think he started to gain more confidence in me and he started showing me the evidence. Yeah. And, when that started to occur and he started to open up about to me about what was going on. And I think it also had a lot to do with his relationship with these beings. He literally had to go through them to get their opinion as to if it was okay to talk to me.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that's how it kind of progressed. And we were both shown, as time went on, both shown different aspects to this phenomena. And, you know, at that time, David had had, when this first started, David had had crippling arthritis. I mean, literally, it was really bad. And he was healed through several surgeries over subsequent evenings. And, you know, I saw the proof of that. And, you know, when he first started noticing what was going on, it occurred in his bedroom. And, you know, this is the very beginning. He and his wife started hearing these noises, like something was moving around. And the first thing they thought is, look, we have a haunted house or something. Yeah. Even though he built the house, you know, he built that house.
Yeah.
And so it got to the point where he was starting to set up equipment to try to capture this thing. And eventually it got to the point where he did see something and it wasn't what he thought. And then the portal started opening up in the bedroom. And he was literally looking into this portal and seeing another world or another location, which was actually this cavern where he had talked about, this huge expanse, which he was eventually taken into, and his family was abducted with him. You know, the whole story, I have written about it in my last book, Alien Disclosure, where he, you know, I'll go into detail of a lot of what happened, but, you know, I had been talking to David for a lot of years, and I still really haven't told everything. I don't know if we're really ready to hear about everything. There's a lot there that is bad enough.
Yeah.
that's pretty, you know, it's pretty hard to read or to hear about. But, you know, the alien phenomena is it's not all fun and games. You know, a lot of people talk about, well, I wish I was abducted. I'd like to have an encounter. And no, you know, you don't want to go through that.
Yeah.
It is not what you think it is. I wouldn't wish it on anybody. And, you know, I've talked to people over the years who thought they had a good encounter. And but I've talked to way too many more people that have had adverse encounters. Mm. So, yeah. So, you know, in his case, he's been lucky enough to eventually moved to another location. And he's still having these encounters where they are literally coming in to his home. And it's different types of entities. Mm. And he's been lucky enough to be able to photograph some of them through various filters and techniques. But it's an intriguing story.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very perplexing case because, as you said there, when you first read how the phenomenon begins, I was exactly like you when I first started reading about him a few years ago. I just, it really did sound like they'd got ghosts. Because yeah. How it was, you know, I think his wife once rang him at work terrified, saying that she could see people walking through the house.
Mm-hmm.
And through walls and doors and things. And like you say, he'd built this house. So this was just like a vacant plot. And it just suddenly seemed to take a real left turn, Lon, from what you would normally expect as to be a paranormal series of events to becoming something which, once you've read into it and looked at the photos and heard David speak, it's absolutely terrifying. Like you refer to, I think some people are very flippant about this. And I think what's interesting for me, David's case is one of those where it's very similar that he's got a very kind of, whilst he's benefited from it in a positive way physically, I think it's clearly affected him and his family a great deal on a psychological level.
Oh, yeah. I mean, his family has broken up from it.
Mm.
I mean, it got to the point where his wife really just couldn't stand it anymore. And, you know, his children are somewhat estranged, but, you know, he still talks to them. He still has communication with them. Mm. But it did. It led to some issues. And especially when it came down to these beings trying to breed with him.
Mm.
You know, like I said, I've got it all written out in the book. It's, you know, in detail, but it's quite an interesting story. And, you know, I was able to get a TV show that I don't know if you're familiar with in the UK, but it was titled Fact or Fake Paranormal Files.
Yep.
And the team that went in there, you know, they go in to try to disprove everything, you know, of course.
Yeah.
And they just couldn't do it with him. And you know, I had talked to the Ben Hansen, who was the lead investigator yeah. on that show. And, you know, I was a little bit unhappy with some of the way some of the things were portrayed. But the one instance that they really couldn't figure out was the earthworm incident. Now, what happened was, now, David had told me about this before. Hmm. Each time there was the portal would open up or they would be taken, the next morning when David would come out and go to work, there would be earthworms everywhere. Literally, nightcrawlers had popped up all over the place. It was so bad he had to take a hose each morning and wash them down into the street.
Yeah.
because they were all, in fact, his neighbors were all pissed off about that. And, you know, I don't know what kind of excuse he used with them when this was going on. But anyway, when the Factor Fate team was there, they had David in the bedroom, and there was, and one of the investigators was in the bedroom, and they had a the van parked out in front of the house, and one of the investigators was up in a tree at the window looking in to David laying on the bed, sitting on the bed in the bedroom. Well, anyway, what happened was the equipment started going haywire. I mean, there was a massive electrical interference. And David said, "I hear piano music. They're here." Now, this thing with piano music, that did occasionally happen. Mm-hmm. He told me that he would occasionally hear piano music, which I don't know was some type of indicator by them to let him know they were there. Well, anyway, they had this massive electrical problem in the van, and the cameras were going in and out and such. And after about 5 minutes, it all went back to normal. So Ben told me, he said, you know, I walked out of the van, stepped onto the street, and I walked up to the lawn, and there were earthworms everywhere. It was like an electrical shock had gone through the ground and just lifted these things out of the ground. And this was something that had happened so many times. I'm glad they caught that because, quite frankly, David never told them about that. So...
Yeah, I mean, it's a show I watched religiously when it was on, because it was, like you say, that the whole setup of the show was that they would take notable cases and as you say, try and disprove it. And and I'm trying to think, was David's the one where they tried to claim that perhaps he was using balloons to photograph these aliens?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I just thought, well, what?
Yeah, and that's what I was upset about, because they were using, like, these wooden mannequins and... balloons and you know, David had taken some fairly interesting photographs. There was a the one with the balloon that they tried to mimic was of a tall, like, gray being that kind of shape-shifted into a reptilian type being, and you know, from what David had told me. Now, the photograph that he had taken wasn't that great, but it was, you could see the shape. But, you know, David had was able to take all kinds of photographs using, well, he actually, what he did use, he was using some smoke machines, which was interesting. And he was actually getting photographs of these small grays as they would cloak themselves. And when this, you had this smoke machine on, it was picking up their outline. It was very intriguing, but he caught some very interesting photographs in the early stages of this phenomena. But recently, in the past year and a half or so, he has captured some really unbelievable photos. I don't know if you've seen them or not. I occasionally have released some. I put some of the newer ones in the book, the new book. But they are quite intriguing. I mean, all types of different entities. And, you know, he tells me that he really doesn't know what some of them are. They do communicate with him occasionally. And this was another thing that was intriguing. This reptilian being who seemed to be there all the time when he was abducted, actually spoke English to him. Now, they did it telepathically occasionally, but it was mostly done, you know, in sound or voice audio. So it's a strange case, and it still goes on. And in fact, he sent me a bunch of photographs last night that I'm looking over. But, you know, he uses various ways of filters, large glass. Because when they have an indication that he's photographing, they will blast whatever it is. He has gone through so many camcorders earlier He showed me a couple of the fried ones, and he goes through his cell phones like, you know, we go through anything, you know, disposable. Yeah. I mean, they do really rip them up. So I don't know what kind of energy it is that causes that, but he has, I think some of the more intriguing photographs he has taken are of the transporting devices that show up, the teleports that open up, and where these beings actually walk out of them. And yeah, it's you know, I've had a lot of people look at them. I've had a lot of psychics look at them, and they're just flabbergasted.
I think what's very interesting as well, there are two aspects to when David's story first sort of hit the headlines that make me smile. On one is the description. I believe he says one of the reptilians, or the thing that he communicates with the most, doesn't really like humans, and he's very grumpy.
Oh, he is.
Which I always found one of those marvelously amusing little tidbits that you just think, well, that's just something that you don't expect in this kind of thing. Because normally when we hear of... the thing about David's story that I find is obviously the negative aspect of how it's affected him and his family. There are some really interesting parallels with what happened with Whitley Strieber,
right,
in regards to how he viewed it, because obviously Whitley's got a very negative kind of, and quite rightly, with what's gone on. And I was fortunate enough to speak to Calvin Parker last year as well, who's the Pascagoula incident. These people don't, it seems to have, we've gone from this kind of, these, you know, with the greatest respect, people like Adamski in the 50s, these tall tales, Lon, where people were coming from otherly worlds to share intelligence and knowledge with us and save the world. And we seem to have gone now where these, you know, several high-profile cases from people such as David and Whitley, there's a real negative aspect to it, whether, you know, either through contact or just the whole psychological damage it's doing to these people.
Oh yeah, it does occur. You know, I, like I said, I've known David for over a decade now, and it has affected him. I mean, that's true. It has affected him. The fact that he continues to do this and to allow it to happen, though I don't know if he has much power to stop it, if he even could, because they, he has made attempts to stop it, and they have, let's put it this way, they've kind of basically fought back. The one instance was where he, and this was more recent, but, and I wrote about it in the book, that they actually showed a female hybrid to him, and he knew instinctively that it was his. He knew it was, you know, like a pre-teenage girl, and he knew this girl was his child. And you know, he had been acting up and getting upset with them, and then they presented this girl to him, but they wouldn't let him come near her to touch her, to talk to her, and he just kind of pulled her back, saying, you know, she's here with us. You either cooperate or, you know, you're not going to see her, or something may happen to her. That was the indication. So, yeah, I mean, there's a real dark side to these things. You know, the fact that they did kind of take him under their wings, to say, and show him a lot of aspects of what, how they live and how they exist. They showed him some interesting, benign things, but they showed him a lot of bad things as well.
Yeah, there is, like I say, from everything I've read, Lon, and a lot of it is obviously through yourself, you know, in your book and on the website. I find it a very disturbing and frankly quite frightening series of experiences that this gentleman is claiming to be having, regardless don't wish to sound like I'm being ambiguous, but you know, at the end of the day, he's clearly having these are very, very negative, kind of, like you say, it's almost as if he's got no control of this, no matter, like, you know, as you refer to there, he's tried to kind of control the situation. He has no control of this situation.
No.
And I don't think, like you say, when you cover that point, it seemed to be kind of, they took it quite antagonistically. They thought they found him quite threatening in the fact that he didn't want to be involved in this anymore. And essentially, like you say, just, you've got no choice. This is just how your life is now.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's kind of resigned to the fact now that he's going to be experiencing this till his day he died, until they just cut it off. Mm-hmm. He has tried, but unfortunately it just has, you know, this is going to be part of him. And, you know, he's been deemed by them to be, I don't know if they're social experiment, but it leave no doubt he's an experiment to them.
Do you think, because of the other thing that struck me as well, Lon, is I know when you first reported this story, you were very surprised that how little people seem to be interested. And I know you've touched on something. I've always found that really odd in regards to MUFON, that they don't seem to want to embrace contact, you know, where we have close encounters of the third and fourth kind. It seems as if, unless it's flying in the sky, anything else that they just don't seem to really want to dig into. And I've always found that peculiar.
Yeah, they they have people in MUFON that they say are entity investigators for the most part. But when these people get involved with a certain case or try to get involved with a certain case, they gotta clear it with MUFON. And in fact, one of their chief investigators, who's a friend of mine, tried to get involved with David's case, and they just told her to back off. So for whatever reason, when it comes to entity cases, they just don't seem to really be interested. You know, it's also interesting, and I mentioned this at one point, this phenomena in Chicago. The first sightings were reported to MUFON, even in the 2017 sightings. We got the initial sightings, the initial reports off the MUFON database, and they weren't following up on it. So we eventually were able to find one of the witnesses and talk to them and get the full details. So when we started forming our own conclusions and then talking to the witnesses and going further into the cases, then MUFON felt, well, maybe we should get involved with this, you know, don't let them start taking all the credit. And that turned out to be MUFON approached me wanting to work along with me, but, you know, I agreed to that to a point, but, you know, that's a two-way street.
Yeah.
You know, me giving them information and then not providing anything to me, that isn't going to work. No. So I just cut them off completely. And in fact, one of these more recent sightings in around the O'Hara International, which there have been many recently, was originally sent to MUFON. And the witness was very upset with the MUFON field investigator, because he just wanted to put it out there, all his personal information. And he told him to pound sand, and he eventually found me, and he and I talked. So, I mean, that's the way it works. That's fine. If MUFON wants to be that way, I'll follow up and go for it. But, you know, that's the way they work.
Yeah, I mean, it is strange as well, like you touch on that. Strangely enough, I was watching something the other day about the O'Hare case again, because I've always found it really odd. And like you say, the explanation that was given is quite strange, because they basically claimed it's a hole punch cloud, I believe. which is caused when snow basically causes too much weight and the whole cloud drops out. And they were saying, oh, well, this is what's happened, which there was the weather on the day of the, you know, the initial rash of sightings of these strange objects above the airport.
Yeah.
It was a mild sunny day. It was too warm for anything like that. So,
yeah.
And nobody reported seeing snow. Nobody reported seeing snow fall. There's no reports of anybody seeing snow. But that's what they just dismissed it as, which ignored, like you said, these were all experienced. A lot of them as well were airport staff. They worked there. They knew the environment. They knew how their place of work looked on a day-to-day basis. They knew they could see things in the sky. And it's as if that often, Lon, for me, the explanation is often as baffling as the actual witness and their peculiar sightings.
Yeah, they convolute these sightings, especially that original O'Hara sighting with the saucer that they saw go through the clouds. And that's been almost a decade ago, but you know, that was a convoluted response that we got from MUFON on that. And in fact, over the years, there's been a lot of other phenomena reported at O'Hara, quite frankly, and it just never got out there. You know, now that these entities are starting to be seen on airport property and in Rosemont, which is just northeast of the airport, you know, we've gotten eight reports now. But the last three reports have actually been in the cargo areas of O'Hara International.
Yeah.
And this has all been going on since the beginning of October. And in fact, the last encounter that was reported to Manuel, who reported it to me, and it was actually by a TSA officer. Wow. So, there's some substantiation to these reports. People are definitely seeing something, and it's just not some type of person in a suit or something else. Something very unexplained is going on out there.
Yeah, I mean, and once again, you say there, these witnesses are the typical type of people who know only too well, Lon, that coming forward, the ramifications could be damaging both personally and professionally. So this is what I'm always impressed by, especially someone like you refer to there, because they've got everything to lose by coming forward.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you know, and that's why we're so careful on how we report these things, because we don't want it getting back to hurt them. And, you know, he was very worried about losing his career because of this. And, you know, we've also had police officers report these sightings as well. So, you know, and in fact, we've got four incidents of police officers in Chicago being a part of a sighting, and also someone who worked in the mayor's office also had a sighting. So, we're pretty careful about who we disclose or how we do it, because we keep all that information confidential.
Yeah. Well, I think you have to, because, you know, and I've said to several people over the course of my show, Lon, I'm always really struck by anybody that goes public, you know, with their name and whatever, regardless of the type of phenomenon, because they are essentially just putting themselves out there to have their character assassinated.
Yeah, I think I've had my character assassinated more than a few times.
Join the club.
That's part of the job, unfortunately. But, you know, you got to put it out there to get any type of notice.
Absolutely.
But I've heard a lot over the years, and I've been doing this about 40 years now, but it's, you know, you do get questioned a lot about this. And, but of course, when somebody reports their incident to me, I become part of their story. So I feel responsible for, you know, them beyond just the report. I mean, you know, they've got a life to live and they don't need any problems beyond that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and it is always one of those things. I was watching something strangely about the Hopkinsville case.
Mm-hmm.
And a very well-known skeptic basically just said, oh, yeah, they were all alcoholics and they were drunk. And I just thought, how on earth can you say that? Because that's deeply offensive on several levels, Lon.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, yeah, well, I spoke to one of the officers and he said there were some beer cans in the bin. How many? Because there's 11 people in this house, for a start. And if you are going to go down the tangent of these people were all drunk and seeing things, that's a hell of a lot of beer for somebody who lives in the middle of nowhere to be drinking.
I always say a skeptic is a skeptic until something happens to them.
Yes.
And believe me, I've had many people who had, you know, that totally didn't believe any of this type of stuff, any type of phenomena, until it happened to them. Mm. And then they're true believers all of a sudden, you know. And look, I've had to deal with skeptics my whole life as far as this goes. And, so, you know, that's kind of like water off the duck's back to me. I just kind of let it go. It used to bother me, but it doesn't bother me anymore.
Absolutely. I think that was quite, you know, like we were touching when we were talking about David's case, Fact or Fate, which was obviously, like you say, was shown over here and it's still on running now. I think it's repeated endlessly on the Sci-Fi channel in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
But I have found that quite interesting because, as you refer to, the guy who was leading it is, was it Ben Hansen?
Yeah, Ben Hansen.
So Ben was ex-FBI, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And something seems to have happened to him over the last few years because he's gone from being an outright skeptic to now, essentially, I think he's a little bit more open-minded, Long, because I think he's certainly doing a lot more in regards to paranormal investigations, isn't he?
Yeah, most people that start out like that, you know, kind of having a closed mind, after they start doing all these investigations and start getting deeper into this, they usually kind of open up a bit more. I've seen it way too many times, quite honest with you. You know, you were talking about Linda Godfrey. I've known Linda for a good while. Linda was strictly flesh and blood in the beginning. And now she's more open-minded about the phenomena now. And I think a lot of investigators who started out early with the, these are beings that are flesh and blood and walking about are kind of a little more open-minded about the phenomena.
Yeah. Like you say, I think it's one of those things that eventually it's just a culmination of evidence and experience that basically, if you keep that closed mind, you essentially are ruling out any aspect of potential, and therefore it's kind of a dead end because you
don't. Yeah, it is.
You're not looking for an explanation. Well, you have a solution. You're just trying to fit it in to the phenomena you're exploring.
Yeah, it does. You know, I guess it can drive you crazy, I guess. when I first started out with this, you know, just like when I had the Bigfoot encounter, I knew I saw a Bigfoot. You know, when I saw that thing, I was convinced that, yeah, this thing walks about. This thing is actually, some type of flesh and blood being. It's tangible. But, you know, as years gone by, and I know I saw it, I still have questions about it. And, when it comes to cryptids, I really can't say that all of them are any of them are flesh and blood. I mean, they're, you can listen to all the witnesses you want and take all the information they've got, but there's still always going to be questions. You know, that's just the nature of the beast.
Yeah. Well, I think that's what, you know, human nature is to question. And when you start questioning things, Lon, I think that you're in trouble straight away because you basically just accept things, and that's never a good place to be.
No.
Yeah, but you know, questioning is human nature. I think it's one of the aspects that makes us human is our ability to challenge and question things. That's how we've ended up in the place we are today, I think.
Yes, I believe that.
So, what's currently on your radar, Lon? What's have you got anything you're going to, apart from everything that seems to be going on? So what are you getting your teeth in at the moment?
I've been working on a book. It's kind of been up and down. What I'm doing, I'm writing on a book about flying cryptids, but I'm following up on the Chicago phenomena, and I'm trying to keep up to date with that. I don't know how much I'm going to be able to get in with other flying cryptids. We're going to keeps expanding. But it's I've been working on that now for about 6 months, and it seems every time I sit down and say, okay, I'm going to write this, I something else comes up. I've got a group which is titled the Phantoms and Monsters Fortune Research Team, and I've got a really good group of investigators and researchers. Tobias is part of that, his wife as well, Emily. And I've got Butch Wilkowski, Tim Renner, Sean Forker, several people here in Pennsylvania. Plus, I got a few others that I've been adding to the team. And we kind of look into everything. And the advantage to this is I get a lot of reports. I get a lot of people calling me and sending me emails and stuff all the time. And if I get something that is very interesting, I want to be able to get somebody with boots on the ground to follow up on or to talk to these people. So by having this group, that affords me the opportunity to do that. And the one thing about Phantoms and Monsters, the blog itself, is I pride myself in offering the readers what I get, not just the old sightings and stuff and the old stories. I used to do that a lot, but I want to be able to present new cases and cases that are just brought to my attention. And also cases where we've been actually working at it. That's the appeal of the blog. So that, that's been expanding. That's been getting, I'm getting more and more busy with the blog as time goes on. Of course, I've got Arcane Radio, which is a live show I do every Friday night at 9 p.m. Eastern time. And it's also a blog, a podcast as well. So I go ahead and I go ahead and upload that each week. And as far as the books I do have out, I have several books, but the last two were The Mothman Dynasty, Chicago's Winged Humanoids, and my last book was Alien Disclosure, Experiencers Expose Reality. And that book are all cases I have personally worked in, or friends or colleagues who had encounters or cases. And it's a book I've taken me many years to write, but I'm quite sure people will find it quite interesting. And there's a whole chapter in there about David and his saga as well. So there's a lot there.
Yeah, absolutely, and I recommend them highly. I have several of your works, Lon, and thoroughly brilliant books they are too. And it's interesting, like you say, because what I've always enjoyed about your site and your work is that you cover a variety of phenomena. And I've always appreciated the fact that you haven't kind of stuck to one thing. You're a man clearly seems to love all kind of weird and wonderful things.
Yeah, well, that's what I do, and as long as people offer me, their encounters, their experiences, that's what I'll be working on. So,
Fantastic.
it keeps me busy.
Absolutely. So where can everybody keep up to date with the blog and the YouTube channel then, Lon?
Well, you go to phantomsandmonsters.com, and that's the actual blog site, but you can get a free newsletter, daily newsletter. There's a place to sign up for it on the blog site. And Arcane Radio, you can basically find it at any podcast outlet that you use. I also have it up on YouTube. Just search my name, Lon Strickler, and it'll come up. I'll have books on or on Amazon. Just search Lon Strickler, and they will come up as well.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, I recommend all parts of your wonderful entourage of work to anybody that's listening, because like I said, I've followed your career for a long time, Lon. It's a real pleasure to get the chance to speak to you. So thank you so much for your time today. It's been a real pleasure.
Well, I appreciate you having me come on.
Hey, anytime. Take care, Lon.